hearing is 2021-801, the State of Ohio versus Andre Stanford. For the appellant, Ms. Bremke. You'll pull the microphone down so we can hear you, please. Thank you,
Chief Justice, and good morning. May it please the court, my name is Giovanna Bremke, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Andre Stanford. All of you, the prosecutor, the attorney general, and myself all stood and held our hands and vowed that we would uphold the laws of the Constitution. And I would submit to you that there is only one way to do that in this case, and that is to rule that Mr. Stanford's speedy trial rights were violated and that his remaining charges should be dismissed. Remaining convictions, I'm sorry. This case involves Mr. Stanford's right to a speedy trial. Some cases involving speedy trial involve complex time calculations and tolling. The students in this room will be happy to know that there is none of that in this case. So let's talk about what we do know. Mr. Stanford was in a vehicle accident in which his vehicle collided with a motorcycle. Him and his brother, who were the passenger, fled on foot. That gentleman unfortunately passed away. Within a little over an hour, Mr. Stanford was taken, his blood was drawn, and he admitted to smoking 2 marijuana blunts and drinking shots of whiskey. He sat unable to post a bond for 105 days. So the only calculation you'll have to do is on a triple count, that is 315 days. We know that the magical number for speedy trial is 270. So there's no dispute that he sat for longer than that time. This case involves whether Mr. Stanford's subsequent indictment for this case relates back to the original charge. So he was originally only charged with one count of failure to stop after an accident. He subsequently gets indicted on a 7-count indictment. And the key point in the key case, you will recognize this court's case in State versus Baker. And the holding in that case is whether the facts were known at the time of the first charge, that they do relate back for purposes of speedy trial. And if there are new facts that are not known, then they is a new timetable.
So how were the facts that there was a per se violation known at the time of the arrest?
So let's talk about that. He was, Mr. Stanford, number one, admitted. Again, he admitted to smoking 2 marijuana blunts and
you don't know how much metabolite was in his system, right, until there was a test done.
Correct. Now, let me submit to you that you do not have to be able to prove your case at the time of charging. You'll notice that the state and the attorney general do not argue that they could have charged on that night. Could they have proved their case on that night? No, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about they knew enough, and this is what the 8th District's holdings that conflict with the 9th District, that's what they hold. They hold that in the 1st District, Cooney, they hold that just the mere fact of doing that test was enough to know you could have charged.
And so the rule is that if someone might be guilty of something, the state has to charge them or the speedy trial clock starts running, even if the state doesn't have evidence of that they're guilty?
No. The rule is that if you knew on that night, now again, you don't have to prove your case on the night of, you don't have to know all of those facts, but it would be the equivalent of getting witness statements later on, and would that restart the timetable each time? Because of course you didn't know that on the night of.
But the state didn't know on the night that he was, on the night of his arrest, that he was guilty of a per se violation. They needed other facts before they knew that. This is not adding something to the case. This is the essential fact of the violation.
They knew enough to draw the blood. They knew that he admitted, and that's important. That is something that gets brought up repeatedly in the conflicting cases. He admitted to the use. So that's important. And there was, again, enough to charge him. The evidence doesn't need to be there in order to convict him on the night of. So I want to point out two things. One, the state knew about the information. Justice DeWine
Just to go back to what you said, they admitted to the use, but he didn't admit to having any particular level of drugs in his bloodstream, and that's what the crime he was charged with.
He admitted, to smoking two blunts and shots. Of course, nobody would know what their blood metabolites are, but certainly his blood was drawn not to check his cholesterol. It was drawn because they knew that he had smoked that night. He admitted to that. They knew, that there was an accident. They knew that he fled. They knew that it was late at night, and that, again, he admitted to the use. In addition to his admission, he was actually read the BMV 2255 form, which states on the first line, you are under arrest for an OVI. So that's another significant factor. Again, there, my brief goes through many cases, first in 8th District that conflict with this 9th District's decision. Again, the toxicology reports just confirm what was already known on that night, that there was use, and that it proved what the charging officers already knew. The second thing I wanted to acknowledge is that this court's ruling in State versus Baker, it was a complex case in which there was a pharmacist, there was a confidential informant. He sold drugs to those confidential informants. Later on, where the complexity comes in is that there was a full audit. It took 9 months to audit his billing records. And at that point, he gets charged with Medicaid fraud. So some other charges, but one of them including Medicaid fraud, that's something that but for an audit of the billing records would not have been known on that night. That's not how I believe this court intended for the courts to apply Baker is in this case. This is a basic case. This isn't a elaborate fact-finding case here. And the reason I know this is because in Baker, this court makes reference to the fact that their ruling was for the intention that the state, it would prohibit, if they ruled otherwise, it would prohibit the state to prosecute elaborate and complex cases. This is not an elaborate and complex case. Again, the blood was drawn on that night and there was an admission of use. The Attorney General in their brief also alleges that you should rule, should you rule in favor of Mr. Sanford, that this would require the prosecutors to overcharge. And this argument is flawed for many reasons. Number one, again, the Labrador's arts are only a piece of evidence. It doesn't need to be known on the night of the event. Additionally, the Attorney General's brief, and I want to point out page 17 of the brief, it's should be somewhat offensive to all of you, or at least the majority that were in the DeBose case, the position that they're taking on the overcharging. And that is, well, we have to be able to charge lesser charges, lock these people up, put them in on high bonds, which happened in this case, $100,000 bond, on one count of failure to stop after an accident, and get them off the street while we investigate cases and while we accumulate that evidence. And that's exactly what speedy trial and the Constitution was intended to prevent, was incarcerating people and essentially throwing away the key while we continue to investigate. And that's an important distinction there. And significant in light of this court's continued efforts on bond reform and in light of the DeBose case.
Ms. Brimke.
Yes.
In your opinion, did the state have access, once it made its first charge, did the state have access to enough evidence for each element of the new offenses that it later amended the indictment for that could have survived a sufficiency challenge under Criminal Rule 29?
Are you saying at the time of the accident?
Yes.
I believe that they would have had enough probable cause to charge on that night, and that's exactly what I'm saying, that they would have, they're not arguing that they couldn't have charged, and this happens all over courts, all over the place, that they're charging possession charges and not having the lab results to confirm that it's marijuana, heroin, you know, whatever it may be, and the quantity. So a lot of these cases actually deal with the possession in which there's, you know, substances found. And that happens all of the time, that they charge and then later on get the lab results. This is not a case where it's, you know, we need to, you know, incarcerate people and then later, you know, and investigate. These lab results were actually back by the time that this case would have had to go to trial. Within those 90 days, they had the lab results. It's not impossible to get these lab results within the 90 days, and it would require the prosecutors to refocus their resources on the cases that there is not a speedy trial time waiver. That's not what happened here. What happened here was that Mr. Sanford was not indicted by the grand jury until later, and by the time they had realized it, the state actually went ex parte to get his bond amended to a personal bond, which again is another factor in that we don't need to overcharge. You can get more time, even not on a time waiver, by releasing someone. You can get 270 days versus the 90. But it was at the time of holidays, Christmas, and for whatever reason, that entry never got posted. It was a mistake. Human error happens, and that's exactly what the Constitution is intended to prevent, is or to protect, is when human error happens and somebody's incarcerated past their time, that is what this is intended to prevent. I would reserve the remaining, I believe, about 3 minutes for rebuttal, if there's no questions.
Thank you. Ms. Paparocki.
Good morning, Chief Justice. May it please the court, Lindsay Paparocki on behalf of the state of Ohio. The issue before this court today is whether a new clock starts for later added counts that cannot be proven without lab test results. This fact-driven question can be answered by applying the well-settled law laid down by this court in Baker, which governs this case.
Counsel, let me focus on count one for a second. Okay. Does the fact that count six was dismissed below, doesn't that undercut your argument on count one? Count six isn't in front of us now.
Count six is not in front of you.
Doesn't that undercut your argument on count one?
I don't believe so, because count one of the indictment was premised on a RC 4511-19A1 violation. It was not specifically, it was a generic violation, which 4511-19A1 is also alleged in count seven. So Baker and its rule of law is inherently about facts and the state's knowledge of those facts and how to recalculate the speedy trial time clock as it relates to those facts. Here, the facts of this case demonstrate that a new trial clock started for the later added counts that remain at issue in this case that could not be proven without lab test results. The facts of this case also illustrate
why. You said they could not have been proven.
Right.
All right, but the charge doesn't require proof. Are you saying that they couldn't have been brought in good faith by the state, which is, you know, a requirement? What are you saying?
I'm saying that we could not have brought those charges on the night that Sanford was arrested on the original count in good faith, based on a mere suspicion, a hunch, a gut feeling. We couldn't have done any of that in good faith, in good consciousness. We couldn't have done that on the night he was arrested. And I would also indicate that the facts of this case.
The reason I asked is because you said it couldn't have been proved.
Okay.
And so I'm just confused on what standard or what.
Okay. The facts of this case also illustrate why convictions that require lab test results meet Baker's new facts test. In the context of this case, the criminal conduct which subjected Andre Sanford to an original charge of failure to stop in an accident was clear from the outset. Certain facts were known to law enforcement at that time. However, new facts came to rise after the arrest on the original charge when lab test results informed the state that additional crimes had been committed. Those facts came to light after the lab test results returned and provided the state information that he had marijuana metabolites in his blood beyond a legally prescribed limit. These facts were unknown to the state and unavailable to the state at the time of the initial charge of failing to stop in an accident was filed. The state properly waited until it had those new facts, namely the test results of his blood, to indict him as a per se conviction for prohibited substance levels may only be shown with lab test results. Sanford's insistence here that the state should have charged him immediately based on his comments about having consumed whiskey or having smoked marijuana blunts not only oversimplifies the issue before this court, but also encourages broad overcharging by the state. Only because he admitted to smoking marijuana or having drank whiskey cannot provide the state with enough knowledge to charge at the outset of an arrest. His argument is flawed under Baker, but again, induces the state to overcharge. As I indicated previously, we cannot charge on a hunch or a suspicion. We need to have a factual basis to charge and evidence-based prosecutions. Sanford's citations to his admission simply did not provide the state with the knowledge necessary to charge him with a per se OVI on the day one, because only lab test results provide enough evidence to show that he was per se under the influence. We need scientific numerical values to establish that. Under a sufficiency of the evidence, I believe, standard, we have to prove our elements under sufficiency beyond a reasonable doubt to establish that standard at trial. To accept Sanford's approach would encourage the state to charge as soon as possible and before it was satisfied that it could establish his guilt. Sanford's own argument pushes the state to charge at a high tier level without waiting for actual evidence to support the charges based on admissions. Mere suspicion, again, is not enough. This is a risk that should be avoided. His citation to Baker that it only supports prosecutions and charging in complex cases is, we would submit, also flawed, in that Baker has been applied in a variety of cases to support this proposition. If there are no further questions, I'd like it to turn it over to the amicus, the AG.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Carney, and let me note that Mr. Carney is to be congratulated. This is his 50th time arguing in front of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I think you've set the record, Mr. Carney. Well,
thank you, Your Honor. It is an honor to be an officer appearing before this court, and especially to do so for the people of Ohio. So thank you. Hope I do okay this time. Two points show, Your Honors, why Sanford's conviction should be upheld and why new and necessary to the charge lab test results are precisely the kind of new information that triggers a new speedy trial clock under Baker. First, the legal test for when the state knows of a charge is when a prosecutor has a factual basis to believe she can prove the charge's elements factually at trial, not when someone has a hunch or suspicion. And two, the facts here show the state could not have charged, not just didn't have to, but could not have charged a per se OVI without lab results. And that is especially shown here by the fact that no alcohol charge was ever filed, but only the marijuana per se charge based on the metabolites. Sanford's view would have required a day one charge on both alcohol and marijuana, an overcharging approach of charge it all and then drop what doesn't pan out. That rule is toxic for defendants in all sorts of cases, from OVIs to rapes and murders. This court should not impose it. And I want to stress here, we all know 97% of cases are about the plea bargain. So overcharging is not just a matter of speedy trial calculations, but is putting more leverage unfairly on one side of the scale for what's likely to be a plea. So stacking on charges, and my friend on the other side said we should have charged day one, but only mentioned the marijuana charge that was eventually filed. The alcohol charge, now I'll admit there is nothing in the record about alcohol results, but I think we can infer from that, because the lab tech said, oh, this tested positive for marijuana, that the alcohol didn't pan out or that we would have charged that. So his comment that, sure, we shared some whiskey and some blunts, under their view, we should have charged the whiskey and then ended up dropping it later. I also want to stress a small factual thing, but important. He didn't say, I smoked two blunts. He said, my brother and I shared. When two people share, you know, this could have been 90%. The brother did more. You know, maybe that's why he was the one driving, that he had less, and he never said what the exact time frame was. So what was going on, not only could we not charge, but it would have been wrong to charge, and we would have ended up dropping an alcohol charge. And here's where the appeals courts have done a great job on Baker. There's this big conflict alleged. Most of the conflict, there might be a little, but most of the conflict actually dissipates if you look closely at the facts and the good job our trial courts are doing. The Shaker Heights case, for example, in that case, there was a per se charge was never filed because turns out he didn't test. So the only thing the appeals court was looking at was an impairment charge. And an impairment charge is very different. As this court said in Adams, impairment and per se are on different tracks. There, the police got to the scene, it was a single car accident, and the defendant driver was lying on the sidewalk, not ejected from the car from the accident, he just got out of the car and laid down. So they said the impairment was self-evident and did not require a lab test, and that's true. And that's why the Ninth District rightly did cut off the impairment charge here. And we accept that. And that's why the state took its lumps here. It accepted losing three counts back at the trial court, another two counts at the appeals court. And that is why if you look at the alleged harms threatened, and I think the court should just look at the Baker test and not just be consequentialist. But if you do look at the consequences, the harms we say of proving overcharging or encouraging overcharging, or that some cases can't get proven and bad guys go free, that's very real. Whereas their claim that, oh, prosecutors are just going to sit on things to go later, there is no incentive to do that. Because at a minimum, if you charge one thing early and another thing late, you're going to lose the early charge. And here, if these lab tests had not panned out, and again, there was never an alcohol one, and the marijuana one part of it was close and another part was barely over the line, is, look, if this didn't pan out, they would have lost everything. Nobody who ever has multiple charges is going to say, let's just let a few go because we can always catch them in the end on that last case. And I also want to stress the kinds of cases that involve lab tests. For example, we've all seen many cases with, say, multiple rape suspects where two or three people are involved in a gang situation or something where you want to test that DNA before charging. Do we really want a prosecutor to put three, including two innocent people and one guilty person, throw them all in jail or charge them all and publicly defame them perhaps as rapists when, well, we're just going to wait and see what the lab says and we'll just drop the ones that don't pan out? I'm amazed that I'm here for the state asking to not force on us this overcharging. Our prosecutors have an ethical responsibility to seek justice, not simply to rack up convictions. And here, this definitely is a formula for overcharging. But again, the legal test that this court has set up in Baker, it works. And if you look at the cases where there's something apparent, look at all the cases that we would have lost. For example, in this court's own Adams decision, 30 years later, they tested the DNA to show a rape and murder. We'd actually, in that case in the 80s, tried to indict for the rape and murder. All we could get was a receiving stolen property charge because the person had kept some of the victim's goods. And that person actually did time for receiving stolen property. And 30 years later, when the DNA came along to get a match, then we said, that's new information. The idea that you suspected, we did suspect. We took it to a grand jury. To go their way would mean not only reversing Adams as a matter of precedent, but would mean future cases like this of later discovered DNA of rapes and murders would go unprosecuted. And this court has said in Bonarigo and Baker itself and a host of cases that the speedy trial rules are about balancing. Yes, a defendant has a right to a speedy trial. We certainly don't doubt that, but also about ensuring that we keep our communities safe by ensuring that we can prosecute people and we can get crimes solved. And that's what we were trying to do here, is prosecute, because after all, someone did die, a motorcyclist just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and to throw out all of these convictions and say we should have charged it on day one. And again, I can't stress enough, their overcharging rule would have said we should have charged an alcohol charge day one. And keep in mind that in Ohio's per se statutes, there is a separate provision. When we file, we have to say you violated this provision for alcohol, this provision for marijuana metabolites, this one for cocaine, this one for heroin. We can't just say, well, you seem off, we'll just sort it out later. In fact, there's even a separate alcohol one for being 0.08 and the super drunk one for being 0.17. We can't even cite you a code provision until we get a test result in that shows what substances and how much. Just because someone says, I took some hits off a blunt with my brother, doesn't mean, oh, you have a metabolite level of 0.20 nanograms per milliliter. I can tell that looking at you. No. Cases like Shaker are different where there's impairment, where there's something. And that's another thing, that anytime you have multiple charges, because that first clock is ticking when you have a combined impairment and per se, we have that incentive to keep moving anyway. Here, yes, mistakes were made. The state took its lumps, paid the price in both the trial court and lower court. But these final two convictions are perfectly valid. We could not have charged them. We should not have charged them. And we implore the court to not try to force prosecutors around the state to overcharge defendants in the name of somehow helping them out. So we ask you to uphold the convictions. Thank you.
Justices, I believe that you could have, that the state could have charged on the night of. But I will buy their argument for a minute that they couldn't have charged on the night of. And I'll offer an alternative. We can wait to charge. Why did they need to charge on that night any of these charges? Mr. Sanford did not have a felony criminal history. And he was not a danger. This was an accident. This wasn't an intentional crime. He could have remained. He's a lifelong resident of Lorain County. They would have been known where to find him on December 6th when they received these lab results, and they could have charged all seven charges on that day. But what the Attorney General and the state want you to believe, it's a scary proposition that we have to incarcerate people, again, on a high bond, $100,000, for one count of failure to stop after an accident. They knew about these other charges coming based simply on that bond. You know that they knew enough.
But when you say they knew, but they didn't have all the lab results, right? So, I mean, shared use, you know, it might not have indicated impairment without the actual test results, correct?
They knew, they didn't have the lab results. I'm not going to hide that. But they knew enough to draw his blood. They knew enough that he had the admission. And what the state and the Attorney General wants you to believe is that they had to that they would have to charge all of these charges on the night of, and they would have had to charge additional charges. But what I'm saying to you is there's an alternative. You can wait to charge. Why overcharge? That's very scary to say. Well, we'd rather overcharge than wait to charge and get it right.
So is your point that they shouldn't have detained him with a $100,000 bond?
They didn't need to. No, they could have waited. They could have drawn the blood, released him from the hospital, and come back and charged seven charges in December.
All right. That's not before us. We're not talking about the bond.
I think it goes hand in hand. I do, because the argument is we will have no option but to overcharge. That's what the state is saying. But there is an alternative. You can wait to charge. You don't have to, understanding that the speedy trial may be beginning, you don't charge that lesser charge. That's scary to charge a lesser charge and say, well, we'll just take our time to investigate now because we can charge this other stuff later. And then you're incarcerating twice, not just once.
Well, when you say wait to charge, what does that look like? So when they apprehend him for leaving the scene of an accident,
they take the blood, they release him from the hospital. Like I said, he was no threat to the community.
But when he was arrested for leaving the scene of his accident, you're saying the officers should not have. I mean, how does that work? How do you arrest someone without charging them?
Well, he turned himself in. So when he showed up to the police station, they could have started their investigation. They could have taken him to the hospital for medical treatment. He voluntarily submitted to the blood draw.
I'm confused how you can say that someone who just killed someone in a vehicle was no threat to the community.
What I'm saying to you is this was an accident. It certainly was not an intentional crime. He didn't go
in. He killed someone because of his reckless behavior, taking drugs, speeding, doing all these things. I mean, that seems like a threat to the community, right?
He had no prior felony history. It's not, there was no indication that he would have gone out again and done this. This was an accident, and he could have waited until the lab results came in order to charge. That is an alternative here.
It had to be proved that he killed someone, correct?
No, they knew that on the night of.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?